that the reasons given by the administration to justify that war, weapons of mass destruction, al-Qaeda links to Hussein, that these reasons have proven false, doesn't mean that the policy is imbecilic. As I said to you already, because our rulers try to mislead us and confuse us, doesn't mean that they themselves are confused. The war in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the war in Iraq is not a stupid blunder. It's not a well-intentioned undertaking that went wrong. Iraq has been very good for a number of interests. It served notice to the Middle East and the world that countries that chart an independent, self-defining, self-developing course will be destroyed. That's just what Cheney said yesterday on that aircraft carrier about Iran, that it might try to emerge as a regional power, and we've got to make sure that doesn't happen. There are really very disturbing things about Iran. You know, you have a new literacy rate of up to 80%. The social wage is being built up. They're recycling oil profits right back into the economy in some cases. Many, many things wrong with Iran, especially with the condition of women. I'm not trying to say that's a society we should aspire for. But what bothers them is that here's a country that's charting an independent course. It's not putting itself under the free market global system. And that's what was wrong with Iraq.
You're listening to a talk by Dr. Michael Parenti on how we perceive social reality. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We continue with the conclusion of the talk by Dr. Michael Parenti.
Saddam Hussein, and here's something, if you want to look at amnesia in the media, Saddam Hussein was Washington's poster boy years ago. The Iraqi people had a revolution in 1958, and they kicked out the British and American oil companies, and they built a democratic country. Well, every time they talk about, we've got to go in there and teach the Iraqis democracy, there's a lie. There's the lie of omission. They forget that they had a democracy. They had a constitutional government, a prime minister. Saddam Hussein's first gig with the CIA was to shoot the prime minister, which he did. He didn't kill him. We just wounded him, and the CIA got him out and brought him to Syria. He later on worked his way in, and with his death squads, he killed, or he drove into exile, or he drove underground. Every constitutionalist, every progressive, every reformer, every Democrat, every communist in the country who had formed this coalition. He even then killed and slaughtered and murdered the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist party. This is the part they never tell you about Saddam Hussein. And then when he was doing that, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They gave him aid. They gave him a good chunk of the oil market. They gave him, they signed him on Iran to go fight, do a proxy war for them against Iran. He was everything. But then he started committing economic nationalism. He kept the economy state-owned. He trained cadres of engineers. He did not turn Iraq into a free market client state. He did not open it up to global international investment. He did not say, come on in, boys, it's all yours. The land, the labor, the resources, the oil, everything. It's all yours. Just give me and my brother Jose or Abdul, whatever part of the country it is, the client leader will say, just give me and my brother Pierre a payoff and all that, and we'll take care and keep the people in line for you. He didn't do that. He was a right-winger conservative, but he did keep a lot of these social programs anyway. That didn't fit very well. Iraq was the example. It was a bad example for the Middle East. It was the example, the danger of a good example. We call it that. If every country in the Middle East starts doing that, or in the world, what happens to the empire? What happens to our free market global system of earning billions and billions and billions of dollars off the sweat, labor, and land and resources of these people? So that was accomplished. You see, this war did accomplish something. It took a independent, self-defining, self-developing country and destroyed it. It may making the world that much safer for the free market global empire. If you want to know what kind of empire the U.S. has, it's a free market empire. Iraq was good for other people. 100 companies made billions in government contracts. Most of them are getting out now because the situation is becoming so untenable. 113 billion barrels of quality crude. At today's prices, we're talking about $6 or $7 trillion, the biggest resource grab in history. Saddam was granting concessions to Russia, China, Brazil, Italy, Malaysia, France. All those concessions no longer exist. They're gone. It's the U.S. and Great Britain. This last March, the accords they worked out. If and when they want to get all that, they get all that oil out. A lot of it is also to keep the oil off the market, to keep the oil prices up. And that was the fight. The first Gulf War with Daddy Bush, that's what the whole fight was, that Saddam wanted a larger oil quota, and he wasn't getting it. And if he did, that would bring oil prices down. That's not my conspiracy theory. That's not my lefty conspiracy theory. That was right in the New York Times business page. It just said Iraqi oil might threaten price floors, blah, blah, blah. The Iraq War also allowed the U.S. to impose, the White House to impose record increases in the defense budget by 30-40%, depending on how you calculate that defense budget. Iraq had switched from dollars to euros as its reserved currency, that is the currency that any other country will take, it's your backup currency. Not anymore. That was a danger. That was a real danger to U.S. creditors and speculators and international dollar finance, which it's back on the dollar. One of the first things that happened is Iraq has switched back from euros to dollars. Iraq supported Palestinian liberation. Not anymore. Iraq had an entirely state-owned economy. Not anymore. Everything has been privatized or destroyed, one way or the other. Iraq was prosperous and of some influence in the Middle East. Not anymore. Iraq today is a total basket case. It's a disaster. It's worse than Haiti. It may never recover, not for the next foreseeable one or two or three generations. I don't know. It's just terrible what's happened. Iraq, all right. That's it. Now, this is not U.S. ignorance or confusion at work. This is not good intentions gone awry. It is deliberate, conscious reactionism and imperialism. Bush and Cheney knew what they wanted to do, and they have done it for the most part. It's true they did miscalculate. It's true they thought the insurgency would be minor, that people would, they may have even convinced themselves that people were going to throw flowers out and greet them and all that. It's true they got a politically costly war that they didn't expect to have. But that doesn't mean they didn't accomplish anything. They've accomplished quite a bit from their perspective. And the empire can lose the war, that is, go home after it's destroyed the country. That's what happened in Vietnam. I don't think they lost the war in Vietnam. Vietnam never really recovered. It now has to take a capital road. I was in Vietnam 2 years ago, and they're telling me that the third generation is suffering from more birth deformities than ever as the, you know, recessive genes combine from all the Agent Orange that went in there. And you can see it. see. I've seen photographs of monster births that you don't ever want to see. You just don't ever want to see. And these kids are alive, too. And so I'm almost done. This brings us to another question about how to think about how we think. Do those who put forth the lies of empire believe what they tell us? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, that an opinion serves my self-interest doesn't mean that I embrace it hypocritically. It might mean, because it so well serves my self-interest, that what? I embrace it all the more eagerly and sincerely. I believe it. It seems very persuasive for the very fact that it's so serviceable. So, do these people in the White House, do they believe in the dominant paradigm? They sure do. It defines their world for them. It assures them of their self-worth. They believe, along with one of their progenitors from two centuries ago, Alexander Hamilton, that the country should be run by the rich and the well-born, and it should be run for the rich and the well-born. They completely believe they are deserving of their station in life. It's called Yale, Harvard, Princeton. As has been said, George Bush Sr. was born on third base, and he grew up thinking he had hit a triple. They believe that America should lead the world and that they should lead America. And they believe the poor are the authors of their own poverty. Just listen to Barbara Bush when she holds forth on that. And the working class are a troublesome lot who need to be reined in along with the middle class, both of whom have to ratchet down their standard of living and their level of expectations a lot more so that the people at the top can get still richer. See, there's only one thing that ruling classes have ever wanted throughout all of history, and that's everything. They want all the best lands, all the resources, all the grains, all the herds, all the gold, the silver, everything. They want all the comforts and protections of civil life, and all the amenities, and while having to pay none of the costs. They want everything. They want you to have all the burdens, and they want all the privileges. Now, do they believe the propaganda they put out in support of specific policies? Well, sometimes they do deliberately fabricate and seem to be aware of it. You know it when you catch them in inconsistencies, when they say one thing one day, another thing the next day. I mean, Alberto Gonzalez, you know, and he said, I didn't know about it. Oh, yeah, I knew about it. Oh, yeah, this. Well, it wasn't that much. Well, it was that. Well, I don't know. You know. Much of the time, though, truth is not even a consideration. It's more like the advertising world. Advertisers don't strive to create truths. They strive to create a sale. The prime consideration is selling a product, not the truth. The question you ask is, will it sell? That's the truth. If it sells, then it's, quote, true, in heavy quote marks. Is the message effective? Is it getting across? If it works, then it's true, and we go with it. If it doesn't, then it's discarded. The approach is purely instrumental. Truth is a purely instrumental thing. Does it serve our ends or not? I'll give you a recent example of that. The recent propaganda line of, you people want to cut and run, but we want to stay the course. We're going to stay the course. Do you know that the Bush team has dropped that phrase, stay the course, because they found out that the public didn't like it. It sounded like we're going to be there forever. And people are asking, what's your plan? What's your game? What's your exit plan? You know? And so they dropped stay the course. Now, was it true? Were they being sincere when they said stay the course? Are they being sincere now when they dropped it? You go figure. At what exact psychological point the self-serving, manipulative, lying sentence is believed by the liar himself is something that's maybe hard to locate, and it's really not all that important. Do they believe in their own virtue? Yes, of course. All people, all parties, all national leaders, all movements believe in their own virtue. But even more so, more than anything else in the world, more than truth, more than if this is a real question in their mind or not, more than all of that, with the utmost ferocity and dedication and determination, they believe in protecting and advancing their own interests. That's what they believe in. If you want to know what they believe in, that's what they believe in. If you want to know what their religion is, it's not Jesus Christ. It's that, what I just said. It's Jesus' wallet. But there is, let me finish by saying, there is room for hope, brothers and sisters. There is room for hope. There sometimes are limits to how well officialdom and the corporate press can finesse reality. Sometimes reality keeps getting in the way. I was talking to somebody, this was years ago, a young guy who had been in Germany. He had been a school kid in Germany during World War II. And I said, well, did you believe all this stuff? He said, well, you know, after a while, propaganda can go just so far. Because we kept hearing about the victorious German armies were vanquishing our foes and going across. But we kept noticing that the battles were being fought all closer on the map. On there, the battles were being fought closer and closer to Germany's borders. And then the battles were being fought inside Germany. And we realized that our armies were in retreat. And that, we were losing the war. And something of the same reality principle applies to Vietnam and Iraq. Officialdom and the lapdog press could not totally ignore the awful and persistent actuality of the war. And that reality sets the limits, is itself the limits of propaganda. It's the limits of propaganda itself. That's as far as you can go. I mean, however, even in those cases, even in the case of the debate about Iraq today, the dominant paradigm still envelops it. Because the debate, and it was true of Vietnam too, in Vietnam the debate was between those who said we could win the war and those who said we could not. Those of us who said that's not even the question, we should not even be fighting this horrible war. If we won, it'll be all the worse. This war doesn't represent the interests of the Vietnamese people. It doesn't represent the interests of the American people. It's a horrible crime against humanity. Those of us who said that did not get in the mainstream debate back in the 60s and 70s. And that's the same thing is happening, you see, with Iraq now. This thing's gone wrong. It's a failed policy. This now, let's get the hell out and blah, blah, blah. The implication is if it had gone better, if we'd killed more people at the right time, it'd be perfectly all right to be there. So keep in mind one thing, that indoctrination into the dominant paradigm does not operate with perfect effect. If it worked with perfect effect, you would not be able to understand what I was saying now. I would not be able to say what I'm saying now. I would be saying something else. This would be a Republican National Committee meeting or something. In the face of all monopolistic ideological manipulation, people still develop a skepticism toward the official ideology. Reality is a problem for the ruling class. Remember that. Reality is a problem for them. Reality is not a problem for us. They are the ones who have to finesse reality and misrepresent reality. Reality is radical. Just remember that. When we say that there's terrible environmental devastation, that's not something we are conjuring up out of our radical ideology. That's reality, you see. When we say poverty is growing faster than the world's population, that's reality. That's not some argument we're making, you see. When we're saying that wages are flat and the top fraction of 1% is making more money than they ever did before and they've got these immense multi-billion dollar tax cuts, that's not something we imagined. That's reality. And they have got to deal and explain that. When we say that Social Security has been the most successful human service program that this country's ever produced, the most successful anti-poverty program, as inadequate and insufficient as it is, And it's a three-pronged program. Remember, it's not just pensions. It's not just pensions. It's also disability insurance, and it's also survivor's insurance. That's reality. And those hooligans have to lie. They have to tell you they're concerned about Social Security. They don't want to see it go defunded. And here's what we'll do. We'll just break it up into little pieces and toss it into Wall Street. And people don't buy it, you see. You can, when George Bush said, and I've heard him say, we have the best medical system in the world, the most advanced medical system in the world, and you've got 40 million people out there. Do you know what it means to face a major illness without any health insurance?
Yes.
Right, you do. I do too, ma'am. I remember going for an epidural shot in my back. I had this terrible thing, a procedure that took all of 5 minutes. Now I got a captive audience. You listen to my problems here. 5 minutes it took, a half hour on a gurney, not even in a room. It was in a hallway that where the gurneys were separated by a sheet on a thing. You just pull it around. And then a friend of mine came, and she drove the car up and helped me into a wheelchair and got me home. You know what they charged me? They charged me $5,740.80. What's the 80 cents for? I mean, what is this? So when somebody says to you, we've got the best healthcare system in the world,
it's best for somebody.
There are parts of Walter Reed Hospital that work very well for the president and the vice president, but not for the foot soldiers who are sent out to defend the empire. That shows you their class concern and their class perspective. So when reality is radical, there's a limit to how many lies people can swallow about the reality that they're experiencing. All social institutions of capitalist society have a dichotomous tension within them. They must sustain the few and advance the interests of the few while appearing to serve the many. Along with ruling class coercion, we have mass resistance and skepticism. Along with institutional stability, we have popular ferment and popular innovation and resistance at times. Don't you ever think for one moment that they don't care what you think. They don't care what you think. Oh, man, that's the only thing about you that they care about, what you think. That's what they're doing. Cheney's trip to that aircraft carrier and all that stuff. Every day they're putting on a show. They're waging their propaganda war, not in Iraq, not in Latin America. They're too. Yeah, they have a U.S. Agency of Information. What is it called? Information, AI, yeah. They have that stuff. But the country, the place they target most with all their propaganda, most of the things they do are directed to the American public because the empire feeds off that republic. So they lie and they conjure false issues to distract or flatter or frighten the people or in some other way to win over and immobilize the public. Or sometimes when they have no choice, they have to actually make real concessions to democratic demands. Years ago, the American philosopher William James observed how custom and culture can operate as a sedative, while novelty and dissidence are rejected as an irritant. Yet I would argue that after a while, sedatives can become suffocating and irritants can enliven. People sometimes hunger for the discomforting perspective that gives them a more meaningful explanation. By being aware of this, we have a better chance of moving against the tide, a better chance of resisting the deadening hand of fundamentalist free market plutocracy, a better chance of exposing the dominant paradigm for the sinister, suffocating, dirty little box that it is. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Yes, I want to go back to where you said there is some hope, and that it's the people have developed some kind of skepticism about all of this, but what do you suggest people do after they develop the skepticism?
Well, to mobilize and to organize individually, there may not be that much you can do as an individual. I mean, I, of course, I'm a special case. I get to speak and write and go all over. But I go on demonstrations. I write letters to political figures for this cause or that cause. I always add my name to the petitions that come to me on the email, and they all seem to come to me. And so these are some of the things you can do, and you can join an organized effort with other people, electoral causes and such. I really think it's very important to be giving more of our relatively limited efforts and resources to political counter-propaganda against what the right is doing. It turns out that people on the left give more money to political things than people on the right. Now, that's news. But they give money to good causes. They're good. I do. To save the whales, solar cookeries for women in Africa, Meals on Wheels for the poor in my community. I can go on with about 10, 15 of these things that I pledge myself to write checks for. I'd like to give more, and I think we all should be giving more, and I do now, I'm giving consciously to those who are putting out political education and political counter-propaganda against the prevailing propaganda. The right doesn't give money to those causes. They want to kill the whales. They don't care about solar cooking and this, that, the other thing. They don't even give money to the veterans groups, the disabled veterans and such, or very little. Their money goes into this thing, everything we're talking about today. They go out to make sure they can control reality. Ideas have consequences. They have to control those ideas. And they've been doing a very good job. The Republican National Committee is vastly more intelligent and more resourceful than the Democratic Party leadership. It's vastly more. The Democratic rank and file and followers are vastly more intelligent than the Republican rank and file. But that leadership is terrific. The Democrats don't have a clue as to what they're doing. They're reactive. In most cases, they don't really quite know. They're always worried that they might go too far. They're always dressing up their right. You go listen to any of those talk shows, and who is it? Who's sucking up? It's the liberals. They're saying, well, I agree with Joe Fascist there, who's his comments. I mean, there's a lot that we can agree on. You never hear the reactionaries saying that. They're not afraid of anything. They push and they push, and they go to control that universe of discourse. They go to control and create the dominant paradigm. They could have written this talk, maybe not as intelligently, and but they, what was the other point I wanted to make? The example, what do they do about radio? What the hell has the American labor movement done about radio? It hasn't done a thing in 80 years. You can't find a single one of them. Your average labor leader, even take a first generation tough guy on the docks, on the street, he rose from leadership. A camera comes, he runs the other way. He doesn't know what to do. That's okay. But they have, in labor unions today, they have a lot of intelligent, bright, articulate, progressive guys. What do they all do? They're all dedicated to helping the membership, getting another contract, seeing if we can organize here. They're doing the work. They don't go out there. Meanwhile, what are the conservatives doing? They've convinced the American public that labor unions had too much power. What a joke. Back in the 60s, they did that the labor unions are obsolete, that we don't really need them anymore. They played their role and fulfilled their role, and now we're moving on. They go out and they put out a line. You can't get one. If one labor union had bought one radio station, but what do the right wingers do? They got Clear Channel, and they go out and buy up 1,200 radio stations. First, they make sure they get the law changed. They deregulate the ownership patterns so there can be greater concentration. They have campaigns. They know what they're doing. What do they do about the federal judiciary? I'll tell you what they did over the last 25, 30 years. They've taken it over. They consciously went out there. Ronald Reagan and his boys, who everybody kept saying, he's so stupid. He's so stupid. And the liberals are never happier than when they're rocking on the heels and talking about how the guys who are giving it to them up one side, down the other, are stupid. They don't even know what they're doing. He knew what he was doing. They went out there. They went to the law schools. They found these young reactionaries in their 30s and 40s and appointed no more judges being appointed when they're 60 and 70. They appointed them in their 30s and 40s so they'd be on that bench for the next half century. That's everyone in the world. Look at the Supreme Court. And what did Clinton do when he came into power? He left half, first of all, he left office with half of the about 100 seats still empty that he hadn't appointed. But when he did appoint people, there was no conscious idea of redressing the balance. He had a great opportunity. He never did because he was afraid, because he was half Republican himself, which is the other problem. So we have to, people always say, what do we have to do? We have to make a counter-propaganda. We have to get our word out. We have to argue these issues. Argue and argue and talk to people and let them know where their real interests lie. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by Dr. Michael Parenti on how do we perceive social reality. Parenti is the author of nearly a score of books on society, politics, media, history, and propaganda. He has a website, michaelparenti.org. Some people have gotten together to try to confront the issue of furthering our personal mental liberation through a 12-step program, Slaves Anonymous. You can find that very interesting website by Googling Slaves Anonymous.
First you told Solomon, through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, then he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. And now you build your fences and you say there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genome of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs pass your test. You own country, you own western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. Sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
Now we'll pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago in the reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. In our reading last time, we concluded with Vaughn addressing the creation of the male gender identity, which she terms masculation. The point she made is that, like other social constructs, the idea of what it means to be a man in our patriarchal society is both arbitrary and reinforcing of a social paradigm that defines maleness in opposition to the woman, so that the man becomes the default human being, and the woman, therefore, something less. Since the original paradigm for gift-giving comes from the relationship of the mother to the child, a person's first experience, the masculation of the boy encompasses within it the rejection of gift-giving as a model for his being in the world. There's a certain irony to this, as you will hear, as we continue in Chapter 5 of Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Vaughn writes, "Thus, what little boys perceive as their gender role at an early age is the incarnation of the sample position itself and a partial incarnation of the word. Being equal to or like the sample, that sample being the father, and taking the place of others become important in the male identity, while other orientation and gift-giving remain principles of the female identity. Making the male the sample for the concept of human cancels the perceived importance of gift-giving. Females and other males nevertheless continue to give to the males whose identities are constructed in this way, overprivileging them and especially rewarding those who do achieve the one position. Thus, gift-giving supports this identity construction, even while it is being canceled by it and judged by it as inferior, even less than human, instinctive behavior. Gift-giving permeates human activities and is still the way we transmit goods and messages, communicate, and form community. We have altered and distorted it, however, using it for the ones and against the many. We are all taught from our earliest days to misrecognize the gift-giving way, and we give it other names: activity, housework, leisure, surplus value, profit. As we begin to recognize the dynamics of the two paradigms, we can give the appropriate value and the appropriate names to gift-giving. The incarnate word. In masculation, males incarnate themselves as the substitute gift, taking the place of the mother, taking the father as sample, and giving up giving. This is the moment of the fall, when the boy child realizes he cannot participate in the material gift-giving communicative way because of the definition of his gender. Perhaps the greatest and smallest mistake humanity has made is to give our babies opposite gender names. Such an innocent but terrible mistake, heavy as a second feather on the scale of Ma'at. Do we sometimes wonder why the spirit of good has not destroyed us, given all the horrors we commit? Genocide, rape, genocidal rape, child rape and battery, the rape and pollution of land and sea, murder of species and of individuals, physical and mental torture. Perhaps it is because the origin of this horror is such an innocent misinterpretation, so easy to make. We have incarnated the word, the process of naming itself, and the word we have incarnated is male. It was only a word, but we have let it dominate our psychology and our social structure. We have used it to alienate half of humanity from the gift-giving norm. After alienating our sons into the non-giving category, we, mothers and fathers, overprivilege and reward them, give more to them than to our daughters. Later, we try to teach them altruism through authoritarian morality or religious precepts coming from the law. We wonder why this is so difficult to achieve and explain the difficulty by thinking that human nature is cruel. A communicative need has arisen now for all of humanity, need for a new term to mediate our human relations with regard to our babies. We need a new word gift for all of those small creatures who are our greatest gifts to each other, to the future, and to themselves. Using this new word gift, one term for both genders, we could stop recreating the problems that are destroying our species, our mothers, and our Mother Earth. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Chapter 6, Marxist Categories. And that's Marxist in quotes, spelled M-A-R-K-S-I-S-T. Communication creates the mutual inclusion of communicators regarding all the different parts of their world. The naming of gender divides the communicators into two mutually exclusive, oppositional categories from the beginning, contradicting the mutual inclusion of communication. Like the opposed modes of gift-giving and exchange, the genders enter into a kind of complementary, though they are not a perfect fit. The overvaluing of domination makes mutual inclusion and bonding according to creative giving and receiving difficult. Bizarre developments, like viewing dominance and submission as mutual inclusion, sometimes appear to be the resolution of this contradiction. Giving to the dominator can become a stable pattern, as occurs with so-called family values. What happens in the distinction of gender is that the aspects of language which involve giving and giving way are identified as the behavior of biological females, while the aspects of substitution and categorization are assigned to males. These two roles eventually develop into disempowered nurturing on the one hand and domination exchange on the other. The mutually exclusive aspect of gender comes from the language itself, where female and male are connected by direct opposition. In order to carry out behavior which is supposedly appropriate for a bearer of one's own gender term, one could conceivably look at the behavior of the other gender and simply do the opposite. In a founding text on the universals of language, Joseph Greenberg discusses marked and unmarked linguistic categories, which are found at the phonological, grammatical, and lexical levels regarding terms in opposition. For example, terms like short and tall, or wide and narrow, and up and down imply opposite ends of a continuum. One of these opposites is usually the One of these opposites is usually the linguistic norm. We ask, how old is the girl, not how young? Old is the norm, what linguists call the unmarked term. According to Greenberg, man is the unmarked term, while woman is marked. To me, the metalinguistic expressions marked and unmarked seem to be backwards. It would seem that the more general, more inclusive term should be marked, calling our attention to it, and the less inclusive, unmarked. Instead, the term which is less important has an extra mark, a prefix or suffix, while the more important term, which is called a zero sign, is without additions. For example, in English, we add an S to the singular to form the plural. The plural is the marked category, the singular unmarked. Even the two terms themselves have their meanings strangely crossed. Marked is unmarked, while unmarked is marked. Greenberg cites Jacobson's article that defines the distinction. The general meaning of a marked category asserts the presence of a certain property, A. The general meaning of the corresponding unmarked category does not assert anything regarding the presence of A, and is used principally but not exclusively to indicate the absence of A. Then Greenberg goes on to say, Thus, in Jacobson's terms, woman asserts the presence of the marked category, feminine, while man is used principally but not exclusively to indicate the absence of feminine. This analysis is counterintuitive for women who have been taught by the school of hard knocks that it is being a male that is the important property, the lack of which defines us as women. Greenberg continues, man, therefore, has two meanings, to indicate the explicit absence of feminine in the meaning male human being, but also to indicate human being in general. Thus, according to Greenberg, the term which indicates the absence of the feminine also includes the feminine when it is used in general. Women are included while the feminine is explicitly indicated as absent. It occurs to me to fantasize that if men and women were words, men would be the marked term with the prefix of the phallus. So according to this theory, less, important, different, while the women would be the zero signs without a prefix or important, the norm. If it is true that man is defined according to the absence of the feminine property, what is this property? Women's property is just the absence of the distinctive property, the mark. And added to this, the absence of property in the sense of private property. Women are indeed the norm, as the lacking and unaccepted samples of the human species. It is on the basis of the absence of the female sample that men define themselves and define humanity. The phallus would be the double negative, the absence of the absence. Jacques Lacan talks about the lack of the lack. It is not surprising that both children and linguists are confused. And the word woe man itself is man, marked with a prefix which perhaps hides the fact that the mother doesn't physically have one. The difference, her not having a mark, is seen as her difference, a lack with regard to the norm to which the male child instead is similar. The word mankind demonstrates the problem. By taking the phallus as the mark of men, and men as samples of the species, women appear to be defective members of an inferior kind. Being the norm has itself become a male gender characteristic, and the phallus has become paradoxically a mark of the norm. The word male and all other words which are used for domination through definition become phallically invested because of the similarity of the male gender mandate and the definition from which it is derived. The word male overtakes males, those who have a mark, who become themselves overtakers and who use their mark to dominate or take over. Placed in positions of authority by their marks, they use their words to define and conquer. Verbal communication among males and females thus must attempt to create mutual inclusion among those who are culturally defined as polar opposites. One pole being defined as superior to the other, the marked norm and the sample for the species. The logical contradictions involved in this situation create damaging double binds, which society has not yet resolved. In fact, many meta-messages about gender are ego-oriented, constructed upon the exchange logic, and confirm the superiority of the male gender. This book is an attempt at an alternative, gift-giving meta-message about gender categories which would serve the need for abolishing them. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. Overvaluing substitution. Since more value is socially given to masculated males, more attention is socially given to the substitution side of language, which therefore holds sway over the gift-giving side in our understanding. A number of self-reflecting patterns develop, which both express the contradictory character of language-based gender and perpetuate it. Substitution, or taking the place of, becomes domination and repeats itself, taking the place of gift-giving, which nurtures it. The male takes the place of the female as model of the human, and women continue to give to males and to give value to the male model. Male behaviors of domination and competition take the place of non-competition, of gift-giving, and giving way. These behaviors replay aspects of the service and substitution mechanisms which we saw in the definition. Giving value is an aspect of giving that continues to support substitution domination in our society. At the level of language, we give value to the substitute gifts, which are words, while at the level of genders, we give value to the substitute, the male, who takes the place of women and other men. Our attention becomes focused on the place taker, and we no longer look at Mother Earth or the mother or any gift giver, the one whose place is being taken. Gift giving itself appears to be inferior. Value is not given to it when compared to substitution, which has usually been stripped of its gift aspects so as to appear more completely the opposite of giving. Then in economics, exchange, which is a mechanism of substitution and giving way, self similarly substitutes the whole gift-giving mode, which gives way. Another expression of masculation is the use of the definition and naming to control the behavior of others through command and obedience, the giving way of the will. After the members of one half of humanity have been given the mandate to be non-nurturing, it is difficult to convince them they should do it at appropriate moments and to a limited degree. Thus, children may paradoxically be beaten, a physical overtaking, for not giving and giving way, for being disobedient or disrespectful. Morality and the law are also structured according to command and obedience, domination by the word. Revenge and reprisal are the consequence of disobedience. Just, quote-unquote, punishment is given in exchange for breaking the law. While what is actually needed is not justice, based on the definition, masculation and exchange, so-called just punishment is given in exchange for breaking the law. Gift-giving is made to seem unrealistic. While what is actually needed is not justice, based on the definition, masculation, and exchange, but kindness, the restoration of the gift paradigm, and the mothering model. A divided community. Virtually everyone in the community takes turns in the roles of speaker and listener. Communication takes place also among people of the same gender, of course, so that speakers and listeners, givers and receivers, can also be of the same sex. Each gender develops its own kind of community of mutual inclusion with those of the same sex, while attempting to bridge mutual exclusion by forming a community with those of the opposite sex. There are thus two different processes for each gender. If forming community also produces our individual identities at the same time, there will be two kinds of identities for each gender. An identity constructed by communicating with the same sex, and one constructed by communicating with the opposite sex. The basic functioning principles of communication, gift-giving and substitution, are acted out in the two opposed gender roles. The misuses of definition and naming, which would otherwise have been relatively neutral and collectively beneficial linguistic processes and mechanisms, are made possible by the invisibility of gift-giving in language and in life. These are both causes and results of masculation and the cancellation of the mothering model. Restoring gift-giving to our view of language and life, and restoring the idea of service and communicative need satisfaction to the definition and naming, can debilitate the patriarchal possession of a reified and dehumanized definition process while taking away the phallic investment of the word. Family values. In practice, the mothering model has been kept in the family and disempowered, not extended to the rest of society. It has been interpreted by the ideological right as subservient to the dominant father model. Families built upon such oppressive, quote, family values are the cornerstone of patriarchy. In them, the caretaker and gift giver is captured in the permanent service of one who dominates her and usurps her position of model for her sons, a fact which at the same time makes her a model of weakness and subservience for her daughters. Instead, mothering could provide the reasonable, workable basis for our social institutions, and gift giving could be liberated as a principle of a better social order. I do not mean by this that the patriarchal state should co-opt nurturing, as has already been tried in many kinds of exchange dressed up as gift and welfare programs. In the U.S., aid to the, quote, third world at home and abroad is almost always a hidden exchange to the benefit of the so-called givers and to the detriment and humiliation of the receivers. Nurturing from the male model, even the collective male model, has not worked, as many costly examples of communism, state capitalism, and bureaucracy have shown. Rather, governments should be reorganized to rid them of competition for dominance, so that individuals and relatively small groups could take part in nurturing one another. A transformation of this sort would also require the creation of abundance through the cessation of waste. Presently, scarcity is being artificially created through waste spending on products which do not nurture life, armaments, drugs, symbolic luxuries. These expenditures deplete the economy of the many in order to allow the continuation of patriarchal socioeconomic systems of exploitation and the overprivileging and power of the few. It is important to look at language for clues about how to organize society, because language has the characteristic of being both individual and social, both in our own minds and in those of our groups, as a major creative factor in the formation of our individual and collective identities. It helps to bridge the gap between the single person and the multitude. Exchange, constituted by a mechanism of substitution and giving way, as a derivative of the definition, is a very strong self-reflexive template which pulls us toward interpreting everything in its image while at the same time hiding gift-giving. If we can point out, understand, and demystify its mechanisms, and restore the principle of gift-giving in abundance to our idea of language, then we can use language as a guide towards creating a mothering society at home here on Mother Earth. Gift-giving and its values are already available. We must only alter our perspective and take off our patriarchal glasses to see them. And I've been reading from For Giving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. And you can download this entire book online and find out more about the gift economy at gift-economy.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests on the web at unwelcomeguests.org.